Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on what the hell's going on here when we come back. You know, with an income of $50,000 a year, you're paying $7,650 in Social Security taxes if you're self-employed and paying that 15.3%. Well, then, shouldn't you subtract that $7,650 from your $50,000 income and then pay your income tax on the $42,350 balance instead of paying 17% of that $50,000 a second time? But you know the IRS makes you pay 15.3% of $50,000 once in Social Security tax. Then they make you pay 17% of that same $50,000 twice in the income tax. And that means that you pay 17% of the $7,650 twice. And that little bookkeeping trick steals an extra $1,300 from you and from everyone else that pays that tax. Now, what would you think if Sears, Penny's, or your credit card company charged you twice like Social Security and the IRS does? I thought you'd think that's just real special. Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call us here at the Law School. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. It's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining. It's educational. It's informative. And best of all, it's free. Tax and status is available. That's our school on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on the email machine. Send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org, or call us direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about newsletters and what the hell's going on here. I asked some questions and I said, how can this be? And the last time I was reviewing the International Forecaster, I happened to get a couple of copies of The Privateer in here. The Privateer is published in Queensland, Australia. And we Americans, in order to get the truth concerning the news or international geopolitics and what's going on, oftentimes go around the world. There are newsletters being written in England and France. You know, there's people in Hong Kong and Tokyo, Japan, and Queensland, South Africa, and Sweden and Switzerland and around the world and Canada. But I've selected three or four that I rely upon pretty heavily, not exclusively, but pretty heavily. Rents and Spiker are a couple of them. The Calamity Howler and the Privateer, International Forecaster, the Money Changer, just to name a few. Now, in this month's Privateer, William Buckler starts off by saying that the recent Baker report on the situation in Iraq is sinking without a trace. It is being replaced by an older military device called a Surge. The talk is all over Washington to the effect that by sending an additional 20 to 50,000 U.S. troops to Iraq, the situation can be retrieved. As history shows, what any surge amounts to militarily is a recognition of the fact that the original design has failed and that the forces in the field are unable to retrieve the situation. Defeat or retreat stares such a force in the face. If retreat, which would follow the force to stay in being, is not allowed for political reasons, then defeat in the field surely follows. It is the specter of this defeat which leads to a surge. In military terms, a surge simply means that the rear depots and barracks are combed for useful men who are then sent into the battle. Having done that, there are no more reserves. We're now facing the Second Battle of Baghdad. The first battle was the entry into Baghdad in 2003 after that long armored run from Kuwait and President Bush's famous carrier landing to stand under a banner saying mission accomplished. Back then, Baghdad was comparatively quiet. Today, it is the scene of a full-scale resistance to the U.S. occupation of Iraq. The present U.S. forces there cannot contain it. Baghdad is the strategic center of Iraq. If you lose Baghdad, then the United States has lost all of Iraq. But if the United States fights a second battle for Baghdad early next year in 2007, it will end up with Baghdad looking like a moon landscape as Stalingrad did. President Bush can't retreat. A retreat from Iraq would destroy him politically. So to save his presidency, he will lose the U.S. Army in Iraq. Now, I'm going to pause right there because when I read that, I said to myself, oh my God, that hasn't occurred since the Germans lost two armies in World War II. The first time was the North Africa Corps under Rommel. It was totally vanquished, destroyed, and captured. Now, the British were about to lose their army on Dunkirk, or at Dunkirk, in 1940. Fortunately for them, they evacuated their army so that it could fight another day. Had the Germans destroyed the British army at Dunkirk, they probably would have won World War II, hands down. But with the loss of their army in North Africa, it doomed their North Africa campaign. Now they retreated to Europe. And in the Battle of Stalingrad, they lost their 6th Army. Now, that doesn't happen very often in history that an entire army is lost. So when Buckler raised that subject here, I thought to myself, well, who else has thought of that, or who else is reporting on that? So we went to Rents. And they've got an article here, Rents.com, and if you want to get a copy, it's www.rents.com. It's easy enough, Rents, R-E-N-S-E.com. U.S. could face catastrophic military defeat in Iraq. What Baker and Hamilton forgot, written by Webster G. Tarpley. I don't know who Webster G. is, but listen to what he's got to say. He said, amateurs talk about strategy. Professionals talk about logistics, so said General Omar Bradley in Washington, D.C. The flawed assessment offered by the Baker-Hamilton report neglects a very crucial aspect of the political-military situation that the United States faces and other foreign armed forces face in Iraq. And that is the danger that the U.S. Army of Occupation might be cut off, encircled, and then annihilated as a fighting force over the next few months. This flaw, in turn, makes it easier for Baker Hamilton to reject a priori the one rational response to the current reality, which is the extrication of U.S. forces before it's too late. We do not need a new way forward in Iraq. We need a speedy way out of Iraq. The real argument concerning Iraq has nothing to do with victory. The issue now is avoiding a catastrophic military defeat for the United States Army in a form far worse than the Baker-Hamilton group has chosen to imagine. The looming specter is the worst of military cataclysms. It's a battle of annihilation on the model of the Romans at Caen or of the Germans at Stalingrad. U.S. forces attempting to defend a zone of occupation deep within landlocked Iraq now face an extraordinarily critical situation. These forces are wholly dependent on a supply line based on two roads on either side of the Euphrates River, which stretched some 400 miles from Kuwait north towards Baghdad. It is along these roads that gasoline, food, ammunition, and all other sinews of war must be transported by truck and truck convoys. Two roads of 400 miles each adds up to 800 miles of highway to defend. It's an impossible proposition in the face of a sustained people's war by the Shiites of the lower Euphrates Valley. The Iraqi resistance understood early on that these truck convoys represented a grave vulnerability for the occupation forces, and this has been the key to their most effective weapon so far. It is the improvised roadside bomb, known as the IED. This vital aorta of supplies could now be cut in several places at once by the Shiite guerrillas of the Mahdi army or related groups. Now, the coalition of the willing has melted away. Originally, this area, the two roads from Kuwait to Baghdad, were supposed to be guarded by a multinational force drawn from President Bush's coalition of the willing, but almost unnoticed in the United States, and it is not being reported in the news media. This coalition of the willing has totally disintegrated and vanished from the scene, leaving a dangerous void. The 1,800 Italians completed their departure on December the 2nd. The 2,400 Poles say that they're in the process of leaving. The South Koreans are reducing their contingent from 3,300 to 2,600. The Australians have come down from 2,000 to 1,400. The 1,650 Ukrainians, 1,345 Dutch, 1,300 Spaniards are long gone. And also gone are the 600 Japanese, the 462 Bulgarians, the 423 Thais, the 368 Hondurans, the 302 Dominicans, the 300 Hungarians, the 230 Nicaraguans, and the 192 Singaporeans, the 150 Norwegians, the 128 Portuguese, plus assorted smaller forces. All in all, in excess of 12,000 coalition troops have already departed from the southern Euphrates area, or are in the process of leaving. That equals one full division. Now that leaves 7,200 British troops, the remnant of a larger force which the British had fielded for the 2003 invasion. British Defense Secretary Des Brown and Foreign Secretary Margaret Beckett said in late November 2006 that the UK contingent would hand security control over to the Iraqis in the province of Maisan on the Iranian border in January, and then hand over security responsibility in the southern port city of Basra by the spring of 2007. Brown predicted that by the end of 2007, British forces in southern Iraq would be significantly lower by a matter of thousands. The planning for this has been going on now for several months. In short, the most vital logistical link for the U.S. forces stretches for 400 miles through regions now in the process of being deserted by the former allies and coalition partners. This area is very large, and there are no U.S. land forces that are available anywhere to maintain any semblance of security along this 800 miles of vulnerable highway. This adds up to a finding that the U.S. position in central Iraq is simply untenable now that the coalition of the willing has melted away. And this fact must be faced, and a U.S. pullout begun at once before this massive danger turns into a catastrophic rout. Are there any alternatives to this 400-mile double gauntlet from Kuwait to Baghdad? Well, if there were alternatives, the U.S. forces might shift their base like McClellan, moving his base from the White House on the Pamunkey to the James River during the 1862 7 days battle before Richmond. but there are no alternatives to the Kuwait-Baghdad roads. The road from Amman, Jordan to Baghdad passes through Anbar province, where the position of the U.S. Marines is desperate and the power of the Ba'athists' Sunni national resistance is growing. Turkey, angered by the U.S. sponsorship of PKK terrorists, which are supposed to attack Iran but also attack Turkey, shows no sign of offering alternative supply lines through Turkey into Iraq. In any case, the roads coming into Baghdad from the west, the north, and the southeast through places like Tikrit and Baqaba are subject to constant attack by Ba'athist Sunni resistance. No alternative supply lines could come through these regions. Normally, it would be virtually impossible for the U.S. military machine to be destroyed in place. Indeed, it is unlikely that Iraqi resistance fighters could defeat U.S. forces in any pitched battle in the open field. But this is not necessary for the U.S. to be defeated in this way. If U.S. gasoline and ammunition supplies are cut off, U.S. force protection capabilities would be severely undermined. Some supplies might be brought in by air, but this could not be sustained over any long period of time, especially because the surface-to-air missile capabilities of the resistance are improving daily. And the U.S. forces in central Iraq might improvise a Chosin Reservoir-style fighting retreat towards Kuwait. But here again, losses would be extravagant, and much equipment would have to be abandoned. It may be objected that U.S. air superiority makes the eventuality discussed here impossible. But bad weather and sandstorms can disrupt air power. In addition, swarms of guerrilla fighters armed with modern RPGs. Hang on a second here. Let me see if I can do something about the static. Modern RPGs spread out in ambush positions along 800 miles of roads may not be concentrated enough to represent remunerative targets. Where the roads pass through towns and cities, convoys would be hard to defend from the air against urban guerrillas firing from buildings. The threat to the exposed 800-mile U.S. supply line may be compared to the kind of people's war unleashed against U.S. forces in Mogadishu, Somalia, in 1994, not taking place not in one city but along 800 miles of roads. The most dangerous variant would be a simultaneous national insurrection or Sicilian Vespers, or made up of Sunnis and Shiites, targeting most especially the supply convoys of foreign occupiers. I might pause right here and point out that in repeated surveys taken in Iraq, 80% of the people in Iraq want American forces out. Whether that's good for Iraq or bad for Iraq or good for America or bad for America is irrelevant. 80% of the people, when you ask an Iraqi, do you want American troops here to protect you, the answer is, hell no, get out. That's their answer. Doesn't strike me as being a very good place to be. You're not wanted there by the general population. The government there is weak and ineffectual. And now the coalition of the willing, as President Bush called them, has abandoned us. The British are in the process of pulling out of the South. And that means then that the Iraqi government with the Iraqi army combined with the American army are going to carry on the war through this 800 miles now, this 400 mile long road, two roads on each side of the Euphrates River. And so this author points out, well, now let's suppose now that that supply line gets cut off down there, and now what is the American army going to do? Isn't that what happened to the German army in North Africa? Isn't that what happened to the German army at Stalingrad? They got cut off. Yeah, they can resist for a while, and you know they'll fight on. But the ultimate end of that is the loss of the army. Did you want to lose the whole army? And notice here at the beginning here, here's Omar Bradley, not exactly a slouch, you know, when it comes to generals. He was pretty successful in World War II. He said, amateurs talk about strategy. Professionals talk about logistics. I don't hear anybody talking about logistics. This is the first time I saw that, and it came to my attention from the privateer. And I said, hey, Dirk, go look this up. Is there anybody else out there that says, hey, listen, maybe we're more vulnerable than we thought we were? Now, tie this in with Bible prophecy in Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy chapter 28, and with particularity chapter 28 of Deuteronomy, where God says, I'm going to destroy you. Boys and girls, this doesn't sound good. And especially with a president that looks like to me that he's mentally unbalanced. I don't know if the guy's mentally unbalanced. Maybe I shouldn't say that. I don't have any down-to-earth proof that he is, but, you know, everybody, I think, by now, takes a look at Stalingrad. And there was a point in time, you know, when the German army could have withdrew from Stalingrad and saved itself. And their political leadership back in Berlin said, no, sir, by golly, we're going to stay right there in Stalingrad, and we're going to fight, and we're going to win. And that's what our president's telling us. But, boys and girls, the battle at Stalingrad had already been lost. I mean, you know, there's a point in time when military people take a look at the position. You do this on a chessboard. You take a look at your position. And the position is, from this point on, we can't win. Now, when that happens, it's time for you to make a strategic withdrawal. At least save your army. That's what the British did in World War II. When it got to the point where it's obvious that we cannot stop the Germans, they retreated to Dunkirk and they worked mightily to save every soldier that they could to fight another day. And the logic behind this is that at this point in time, when you see that we can't win, this is not a military solution, then it's time to save your army. And it looks like this guy's raising a pretty good point to me. He goes on to say, in technical terms, the Mahdi army would need to deploy its forces in a series of well-prepared defensive hedgehog positions along the two critical roads from Kuwait to Baghdad, possibly supplementing this with other hedgehogs blocking the exits from the remaining British and multinational bases in southern Iraq. These would be positions modeled on the Hezbollah defensive hedgehogs in southern Lebanon, which gave such a good account of themselves against the attempted incursions by the Israeli Defense Force during the August 2006 war. If U.S. forces are indeed devastated in Iraq, it'll not be a historical novelty. In the first Afghan war of 1839 to 1842, a British army which crossed the Khyber Pass into Afghanistan was totally destroyed. Another British force under General Gordon was wiped out at Khartoum, Sudan, in 1885. An Italian force under Baratieri was decimated at Adowa, Ethiopia, in 1896. A British army under General Townsend invading the Ottoman Empire during World War I was pocketed, besieged, and forced to surrender at Kut on the Tigris in 1915 and 1916. The French were surrounded and destroyed at Bien Dien Phu, Vietnam, in 1954. In each case, the arrogance and the racism inherent in the imperialist mentality blinded these generals and other officers in charge to the trap closing around them. Non-European forces were held in contempt and systematically underestimated until the encirclement of the foreign forces had been completed. In Washington, any general reporting on the obvious danger represented by the almost defenseless U.S. supply line would be placing his career in jeopardy. In any case, the report would hardly be taken seriously by the racist third-string neocon civilians still running the Pentagon. To all of this must be added that the situation of U.S., U.K., and other NATO forces in Afghanistan is, if anything, more hopeless than that of the Iraqi occupiers. If the Afghanistan resistance makes good on its promise of an unusual winter offensive this season, the stage will be set for the cutting of supply lines there as well. Afghanistan, of course, is even more landlocked and remote than Iraq, and therefore constitutes an even greater logistical problem than Iraq does. This takes us then to the Baghdad pocket. Instead, the Pentagon and U.S. Central Command appears obsessed with winning what they call the Battle of Baghdad, where they may now be concentrating most of their troops. Much of this has to do with the prominent television and political attention accorded to atrocities taking place in Baghdad, as compared similar events in with outlying provinces. This obsession became overwhelming in July of 2006. In October, the United States generals admitted that they had made no progress. Their response was to send more forces into the Baghdad pocket. The plus-up, or double-down, now avidly discussed by Bush with his military yes-men, is widely billed as destined especially for the Battle of Baghdad. This amounts to sending more forces into a pocket when encirclement is almost complete. Can these military professionals be blind to the ring that is closing in around them? Patrick Cockburn reported in late October that food was getting scarce in some Baghdad neighborhoods as a result of Sunni Ba'athists' interdiction activity, but such shortages would hardly be felt by the career-managing denizens of the Green Zone. Today, the U.S. Army and Marines are surrounded by a cruel and trackless ocean of hostile insurgents, resistance fighters, militias, and death squads. Their rear echelon and vital supply line are in the air, virtually defenseless amid determined attack and interdiction. A serious effort by the Mahdi Army and or the Badr Brigades on the roads north of Kuwait would have a very good chance of shutting down the truck convoys delivering gasoline, food, and ammunition to U.S. forces operating in central Iraq. Now, the only rational answer is to withdraw these U.S. troops now. Growing U.S. hostility towards Muqtada Sadr was signaled in early December when he was demonized by a sinister photo on the cover of Newsweek magazine. The U.S. forces have already clashed with the Mahdi Army once, but with limited success. A plausible scenario of events that would propel Muqtada al-Sadr and his Mahdi Army to cut the exposed U.S. supply line is already in sight. On Monday, December the 11th, reports surfaced that U.S.-backed intrigues were underway to oust Iraq Prime Minister Maliki and to replace him with a new puppet prime minister subservient to Bush's new friend, His Eminence, Abdul Aziz al-Hakim, to secessionist Kurds and to pro-U.S. Sunnis. Later in the week, Senator McCain postured before the cameras in Baghdad, demanding that Muqtada's influence over the Iraqi government be liquidated, a campaign stunt of criminal irresponsibility, which should not be forgotten. Maliki is considered an asset of Muqtada Sadr. If Sadr's man is thrown out as prime minister, and if attacks by U.S. and Israeli puppet forces on the Mahdi army follow, Muqtada might well retaliate by moving to interdict the U.S. logistical aorta between Kuwait and Baghdad, thereby severing the U.S. logistical pipeline. And as of today, Muqtada's 30 members of parliament and 5 cabinet ministers continue to boycott the Maliki regime because of Maliki's willingness to meet with Bush and Amman Jordan in early December. As Patrick Lang has reported in the Christian Science Monitor, Quote, American troops all over central and northern Iraq are supplied with fuel, food, and ammunition by truck convoy from a supply base hundreds of miles away in Kuwait. All but a small amount of our soldiers' supplies come into the country over roads that pass through the Shiite-dominated south of Iraq. And until now, the Shiite Arabs of Iraq have been told by their leaders to leave American forces alone. But an escalation of tensions between Iran and the United States could change that overnight. Moreover, the ever-increasing violence of the civil war in Iraq can change the alignment of forces there unexpectedly and suddenly. At present, the convoys of trucks supplying our forces in Iraq are driven by civilians, either South Asians or Turks. If the route is indeed turned into a shooting gallery, these civilian truck drivers would not persist or would require a heavier escort by U.S. military. It might then be necessary to fight the trucks through ambushes on the roads. Now, this is a daunting possibility. Trucks loaded with supplies are defenseless against many armaments, such as rocket-propelled grenades, small arms, and improvised explosive devices. A long, linear target, such as a convoy of trucks, is very hard to defend against irregulars operating in and around their own hometowns. The volume of throughput would probably be seriously lessened in such a situation, and a reduction in supplies would inevitably affect operational capability. This might lead to a downward spiral of potential against the insurgents and the militias, and this would be very dangerous for our forces. So what about air supply? It appears that only 5 to 10% of day-to-day military deliveries into Iraq are currently transferred by air. Inside Iraq, local deliveries by air probably amount to more. In a difficult situation, the tonnages delivered could be increased, but given the bulk in weight and volume of the needed supplies, it seems unlikely that air resupply could exceed 25% of daily requirements. This would not be enough to sustain the forces currently in and around Baghdad. Moderate imperialists may still find the one reasonable option, the expeditious departure of U.S. land forces, unacceptable. And they should compare withdrawal not with the unattainable illusion of military victory, even at considerable cost, but rather they should be thinking about the total decimation or even annihilation of the U.S. expeditionary force in Iraq over the coming months. This would be a U.S. disaster of incalculable proportions. But it is the outcome which Baker Hamilton and most commentators have neglected. Compared to the thorough destruction of 150,000 troops, a speedy departure of Army and Marines, however embarrassing, appears to be a far more logical course of action and much more attractive. Those who wish to support and defend U.S. troops must face the fact that the only way to do this is to remove them from the ring that is presently closing in around them in the U.S. occupation zone in central Iraq. The Baker-Hamilton report and other U.S. observers talk of chaos, sectarian violence, and civil war as if these were totally undifferentiated and unorganized violence. But in reality, it may only be a question of time until the Ba'athist Sunni National Resistance and the Mahdi Army converge on a campaign to expel foreign occupation forces by attacking their most obvious weakness, truck convoy logistics between Kuwait and Baghdad. Now, in the dream world of Washington discourse, this dire consequence of further deterioration in Iraq are imagined as being visited mainly on Iraqis. Washington operators act as if they had all the time in the world. 9 months for the Baker-Hamilton Commission to deliver its report, several weeks for other reports to be filed, and many more weeks for the White House to evaluate these reports. In the face of an altogether formidable adversary, this conduct is foolhardy in the extreme. And to borrow a simile from Winston Churchill, what if the bear blows first? Let us not wait in Iraq to find out. When the Israeli army broke its sword against the Hezbollah lines in southern Lebanon this past summer, the death knell sounded for the U.S.-UK model of imperialism in the Middle East. Is the U.S. ruling class viable enough to learn this lesson in useful time? So there's the story from Rents. Again, that story, if you'd like to get a copy of it, www.rents.com. And let me give you a mid-course reminder here, and we'll come back and take a look at the privateer right after this. You are listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective, 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law School, or the Law Hour website, rather, is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives and can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one for yourself. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that are used on this program and often endorses and recommends books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may or may not be endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. I might remind you that we're offering a new class on health and healing, which covers the alternative methods being used for the treatment and healing of cancer. I should underline that word cancer and change that to the botch of Egypt, because cancer is a copyrighted trademark of the American Medical Association. And the common word that we use, cancer, you know, like treatment and healing of cancer, you can't do that because it's like making Coca-Cola. It's a registered trademark. But the botch of Egypt, now, that's another story. That's a disease that affects about 50% of Americans, or will during their lifetimes. And how to prevent degenerative diseases and abdominal fat, the use of applications of essential oils, supernutritional foods containing more nutrients and fewer calories. The class also includes hands-on teaching, paperwork, allergic reaction testing and training so you can do it at home, acupressure application and training so you can find the pressure points, and much, much more to contribute to your own ongoing good health. Class will be coming February 5th through the 9th here in Isabella, Missouri. If you're interested, then call my wife, Jackie, the telephone number, 417-273-4967. My wife, by the way, is a 28-year cancer survivor, or botch of Egypt survivor, and it is a program designed to simplify natural healing. Okay, let me go back here to the privateer where we started tonight's program. Now, let me read to you a couple of three paragraphs out of the privateer. This is the late December issue, number 568, 2006 volume. And by the way, the publisher is William A. M. Buckler, P.O. Box 2004, Noosa Heads, Queensland, 4567, Australia. You can also get them on the web. It's www.the-privateer.com. Again, that's www.the-privateer.com. Or you can email them at capt@the-privateer.com. Oh my gosh, they got a telephone number in here this time. Let me give you their telephone number too, in case you want to call them down in Australia. It's 617-5471-1960. Again, that phone number, 617-5471-1960. 1960. This guy is pretty well on point. He's an iconoclast. He's not a group thinker by any stretch of the imagination. He says, straight from the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, in a recent detailed report prepared for the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, economist Lawrence Katlikoff stated that by some measures the U.S. is already bankrupt and unable to pay its creditors. Professor Katlikoff has concluded that U.S. fiscal policy is so far out of control that the country's debt is rising exponentially and will potentially reach an incomprehensible and unmanageable $65.9 trillion, forcing the nation to default on its debt obligations. U.S. fiscal process has broken down totally. That was on page 2. Let me whip over here to page 3. Warning signs. The U.S. Labor Department's Producer Price Index, the PPI, jumped 2% in November as energy prices increased at their fastest rate since the invasion of Iraq in 2003. Petrol prices were up 18% and total energy costs jumped 6%. The core price index, which excludes volatile food and energy prices, was up more than 1% and the largest monthly increase in more than 25 years. This is the trigger. From here on, U.S. corporations are going to see higher costs eat into their present huge profit margins, and they will have to take these higher costs into their balance sheets. If they try to raise their prices of final goods, the ones sold to consumers, then foreign sellers of these goods will cut right into their share of the U.S. consumer markets, and then earnings will go down anyway. The United States' GDP has fallen from nearly 6% in the first quarter of 2006 to 2.5% in the second quarter to about 2% in the third quarter. Can somebody see an economic trend here? And since U.S. consumer price inflation is woefully undermeasured by the official authorities, the privateer maintains that the U.S. is already in recession. And there will be no reliance on dollars, said Mr. Gholam Hussein Alhim. This change is already being made in the currency reserves abroad. The currency move will apply to all oil sales, and it is expected that Iran, the world's fourth largest oil producer, will accept some oil payments in U.S. dollars, but then sell the U.S. dollars for euros. OPEC's U.S. dollar deposits have fallen by more than $5 billion, while their euro and yen-denominated deposits have risen by nearly $3 billion. And $4 billion, respectively. Placements of U.S. dollars on deposit for oil by Russians rose by $5 billion, but most of their U.S. $16 billion additional deposits were denominated in euros. The big global oil producers, OPEC, Russia, and Iran, have started sidestepping the U.S. dollar in their international oil trading. The U.S. dollar is being displaced. And I might point out that dollars and oil have been connected since 1971, when we here in America stopped making payments in gold. Now, the American dollar and oil have been inextricably intertwined or connected. That connection is now being broken. With American dominance in oil trading around the world broken, the collapse of the American economy is imminent. Now, there are 702 U.S. military installations stationed in 132 countries around the world. The U.S. Army has 246,000 soldiers overseas, including 164,000 in Iraq and 17,000 in Afghanistan. I mentioned this to you the other day. I said we have troops in 127 countries. The privateer reports that's 132 countries. So whether it's five more or five less, I don't know. But if you think about it, 132 countries. Now, there's only 200 countries in the world. 192, I think, in the United Nations. Let's just take that 132, and divide that by 200. We have our troops in stationed in two-thirds of the countries around the world. What do you think of that? Why are we doing that? Isn't the world at peace? Isn't the Cold War over? Well, the Cold War may be over, but there's no peace in the world, and there will not be any peace as long as war is as profitable as it is. And this war in Iraq is probably the single most profitable war in the history of the United States. We have spent $500 billion in 4 years on this war so far. Buckler also points out in arguments by descriptive metaphor can illuminate, but they don't explain. In what is written under our previous headline, we've attempted such an illumination. Economically, it is clear that the United States cannot keep piling on both internal debts as well as external debts towards infinity. Geostrategically, it is clear that the Bush administration's enterprise in the Middle East has failed. And if President Bush is forced to withdraw from Iraq, he faces public disgrace, a very low-cost item. But if he loses the U.S. Army in Iraq in 2007, it is the U.S. itself which faces a global military disaster. And if it is the U.S. economy which breaks first, President Bush's Middle East enterprise becomes totally unviable. This much is certain. 2007 will be a tumultuous year strategically, monetarily, and economically. And this was said at a 52-minute press conference, which otherwise contained nothing more than the talking points heard many times before, all of which had clearly been memorized beforehand. But President Bush cannot move forward. He does not have the military means on the ground. He cannot stay in place in Iraq without grinding the U.S. Army to pieces. And he cannot retreat because that would destroy his presidency. So look at President Bush's problem. He can't retreat, and he can't stay in place, and he doesn't have the means on the ground to achieve victory. Whatever it is that this victory would entail, if we could, in fact, achieve it in the morning. My question has been, well, what did we achieve if we achieved victory? What would that be? and I haven't had anybody send me an email and explain to me yet what victory in Iraq would be. Now, if you're talking about money to be made in Iraq, so every day we stay in Iraq is money for Bechtel, Halliburton, Lockheed Martin, Boeing. Those people are making money hand over fist. They're just happy as clams at high tide. Can't blame them for wanting to continue the war, stay the course. I mean, that makes all the sense in the world. What doesn't make any sense is staying in Iraq for Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife. Now, that I can't see. Let me give you a little bit more from the privateer. This is the mid-December issue, number 567. Remember, the privateer is published by William A.M. Buckler. And permission hereby given to quote short excerpts, provided full attribution is given. The price of this is $180 Australian, and I believe that the Australian dollar is about 70%. Let's see if I'm right. 180 times 0.70 means that it costs about $126 U.S. a year, or about the same price as the international forecaster. And I would say this guy Buckler has his head screwed on straight. And I have been recommending his newsletter now for a couple of years. Since I first came in contact with it. This is 2006, volume number 568. Let's take 568 and divide that by 2. It's 284 months divided by 12. I guess he's been in business for about 25 years. That says 23.66. So the guy's been around for a while. I never heard of him. Until say a couple of years ago, and some listener sent a copy of it in. I reviewed it, and then other listeners sent it in, and I get a tremendous amount of material that's sent in here to the program from you listeners out there. And of course, oftentimes when something good comes in, I like to share it. But here's the address here again. It's William A.M. Buckler, P.O. Box 2004, Noosa Heads, N-O-O-S-A Heads, H-E-A-D-S, Queensland, 4567, Australia. And www.the-privateer.com. The real U.S. economic recession has begun. The latest facts are conclusive. The hard economic facts are these, boys and girls. U.S. durable goods orders dived by 8% in October, the biggest drop since July of 2000. Excluding the orders for defense equipment, orders for durable goods dropped by 6%. Orders for U.S. factory goods fell by 5% in October, and Commerce Department said on December the 5th that this was the biggest overall drop in factory orders since July of 2000. The United States Manufacturing Institute's new order index, which makes up about a third of this total index, fell to 48 from 52. That's the lowest level since April of 2003. The U.S. production index, a measure of work performed, fell to 48 from 52 in October. Numbers below 50 signal a contraction. Now, the beginning of the recession was in June of 2005, and I think that it was the international forecaster that put that date on, and our economic forecasts and economic news has been going steadily lower from June of 2005. The Chicago Purchasing Managers Index fell to 49.9% in November from 53%. In October, the U.S. Consumer Confidence Index fell sharply to 103. The Truckers Index of tonnage shipped by U.S. haulage companies was down 2% in October. It's a leading indicator of contraction. Merrill Lynch has called these falls borderline recessionary. and the U.S. services washing each other's cars. The U.S. Institute for Supply Management Index of Non-Manufacturing Businesses, which accounts for 90% of the American economy. Did you get that, boys and girls? 90% of the American economy is in services. Now, it was our GDP back in 1960 was over 50%, over 60%. It was 62 or 63% in manufacturing. We were the world's powerhouse manufacturer in the 1950s and 60s. Today, it's down to 13% of the GDP. Last time I heard, 13% from 60 plus down to 13%. The businesses, the jobs of Americans in manufacturing have been shipped to China and Japan and to Formosa and so on, and replaced with services jobs. Now, capitalism is all about capital, and the data presented above comes under the heading of just the facts, please, and it shows that the real U.S. economy is not only contracting, but it is contracting fast and on a broad front. And worse than that is the fact that U.S. non-defense new capital goods investments, including aircraft, also took an unexpected dive in October, slipping by a massive 5%. 5%. And that's 5% in 1 month, boys and girls. That'd be 60% a year if it kept on. Now, they are the machinery and tools which make all of the economic goods which consumers later consume. But if the investment rate into new capital goods contracts, there will be less total capital plant in the future. And when that future arrives, the smaller total stock of capital goods will produce fewer economic goods for consumers to consume. Deindustrialization always means capital consumption. Real wealth is unconsumed goods. Capitalism is an expanding stock of capital. It is not capital consumption. We Americans are consuming our capital. We are eating it up. And in business and investing, you know, one of the first rules that we use in investing is never, never risk your capital. Americans not only have risked it, they have consumed it. We are borrowing. We are consuming our capital. So economic collapse is not a question of if, it's a question of when. And both the privateer and the international forecaster are picking 2007 as the year. Oftentimes people will ask me, you know, well, what do you think about this or what do you think about that? Well, that's just my opinion. And my opinion isn't worth very much. But I think the opinions of the privateer and the opinions of the international forecaster have a little weight. In any event, better to be prepared than to get caught flat-footed. So there's the story today on the military encirclement of the United States Army in Iraq. It appears like we're being encircled, and it appears that there's a possibility that the American Army will be destroyed in Iraq. That comes from the privateer, from Rents, and from Deuteronomy 28, God himself. Hey, we're about out of time. I've got to give you a final reminder that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through our website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.